terrorist attack. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the first presidential debate, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump said nuclear weapons are the greatest threat facing the United States. They were referring to weapons in the hands of terrorists. But what about the weapons already in our midst? There are thousands of nuclear warheads on U.S. soil, and there have been numerous accidents over the years that could have killed millions of people. The new documentary, Command and Control, looks at an incident in 1980 at an Air Force base in Arkansas when a worker accidentally punctured the fuel tank of a ballistic missile carrying the most powerful nuclear warhead in the United States arsenal. And this frightening story is not the only time we were on the brink of a nuclear disaster. The film's director, Robert Kenner, and investigative journalist Eric Schlosser, who wrote the book on which the film is based, join us to talk about it, and it opens in Bay Area theaters on October 14th. Robert Kenner is director of Food, Inc. His most recent documentary, Merchants of Doubt, reveals how pundits for hire have succeeded in spreading confusion about public threats ranging from toxic chemicals to pharmaceuticals to climate change. And Robert was on, I think it was last year or earlier this year. You can find it at yourcallradio.org, and I really hope you can see this documentary, Merchants of Doubt, and the new one, Command and Control. And Robert joins me in studio. Hi, Robert. Nice to see you. Thanks for coming back.
Great to be back, Rose.
We're also joined by Eric Schlosser, an investigative journalist and the author of several books, including Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. Eric has spoken about nuclear weapons safety at the UN, the U.S. House of Representatives, and several other government bodies. And Eric Schlosser also joins me in studio. Hi, Eric. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks.
So before we started the show, I said, why in 2016 do we still have so many nuclear weapons? And Eric, you said, well, you're bringing some common sense to the conversation. But really, why?
Well, the theory is that by having nuclear weapons, we deter other countries that have nuclear weapons from attacking us. But the traditional question, I mean, going back 50 years in our nuclear policy is, how much is enough? Right after the Second World War, our nuclear war plan against the Soviet Union had us attacking the Soviet Union with 150 to 200 atomic bombs. And that was considered sufficient to completely annihilate the Soviet Union as a civilization. But 20 years after that, the United States had 31, 32,000 nuclear weapons. And when I asked Robert McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense when our arsenal was at its peak in the 1960s. We had 32,000 nuclear weapons. I said, well, how do you go from feeling like you need 175 to 32,000? And he said, you know, each step in the nuclear arms race seemed logical at the time, and step by step by step led to a place of total madness. Mm-hmm. Now, the numbers are down right now, but the United States has maybe 7,000 nuclear weapons. And I need someone to explain to me how those weapons could be rationally used, how even one of them could be rationally used.
Mm. And before you started working on this film, Robert, did you know much about nuclear weapons? Because we don't really talk about it that much.
No. In a sense, this is the most important story that no one's talking about. I had really not been thinking about it much at all until I read Eric's book. I remember as a kid ducking under desks to protect myself from atomic attack. I remember in the 80s being involved in demonstrations that actually helped lead to sort of the shrinking of our arsenal between Gorbachev and Reagan. But no, I really had stopped thinking about it, and it hadn't occurred to me, and that's what made me so interested in doing this story.
And Eric, I remember when you wrote that book, because when it arrived, I mean, it's a huge book, and the first question I had is, how did Eric Schlosser go from, you know, Food, Inc. to writing such a massive book about nuclear weapons? When did you first start really paying attention to this issue?
I was spending time with the Air Force in Colorado Springs. My book, Fast Food Nation, was set in Colorado Springs. And for that book, I went into the Cheyenne Mountain Air Station, which is the headquarters of NORAD, buried deep within this mountain in Colorado. So I was spending time with the Air Force, and I was spending time with members of the Air Force Space Command. We have units that are thinking about and worrying about the future of warfare in space. And I was curious about that. And a lot of these guys had been launch officers in ICBM complexes during the Cold War. And they started telling me stories of nuclear weapons accidents during the Cold War. And one of them had a friend who was in Damascus, Arkansas, in September of 1980, when there was this serious accident involving a Titan II missile. And as you mentioned in the introduction, this accident involved a missile with the most powerful warhead the United States ever built. This one warhead was 600 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima and three times more powerful than all the bombs used by all the armies in the Second World War combined, including both atomic bombs. So I heard that story, and I became intrigued. And the more I investigated, the more problems I found in the management of our nuclear arsenal. And what I had planned as a short book that would take about a year and a half turned into a big book that took about 6 years. But there was just so much information that had never been revealed to the public before. I thought it was important to follow every lead I could.
What was really striking in the film is that you interview the people who were on the crew, who were very young at the time, 23, 24. Many of these guys had no experience, and they were monitoring nuclear warheads. Did that surprise you, Robert? As you interviewed them as adults, obviously.
Right. They were actually, one of them was 18, 19. Another was 20, 21. These guys were very young at the time, though they were really professional. But they, the day of the accident, they had been working really long hours that whole week. They thought they were going back. It was Friday night, and they got called out for another shift, and it kept getting delayed and delayed. And someone made a mistake that could have blown up the eastern, it could have blown up the state of Arkansas and contaminated much of the eastern seaboard. So the consequences of a small human mistake are gigantic when you're dealing with these kind of weapons.
And these guys worked 12, 16 hours a day. And it was striking to hear them as adults remember what they felt back then as young people, 19, 23. You had to be prepared to destroy an entire civilization. Another quote, "I would kill 10 million people and never hesitate."
Yeah. Well, those were the men in the command center, and their theory on deterrence was that you had to be ready to fire to make deterrence work. So that was their way of operating, and it's a scary way.
Well, you know, it's not a historical attitude. I mean, right now as we sit here, there are 22, 23-year-old young men and women waiting to get the order to launch. They've been carefully trained, and the theory of deterrence is that your willingness to launch this missile is what prevents you from ever having to launch it. But the scary thing about nuclear deterrence is it's not like a lock on a door that can't be broken. It's really a psychological defense. It's a threat to mass murder against the civilian population of your adversary. And in the 21st century, we now have groups that are celebrating the slaughter of civilians, that are willing to die on behalf of their beliefs. And so the whole theory of nuclear deterrence may have become irrelevant. It was always a very dangerous way to defend your country, but now it may be a dangerous and irrelevant way.
What has really changed from this incident in 1980 to what we're facing today? It sounds like young people are still at the helm, but what has changed behind the scenes?
Well, I'll just say,
Robert,
we had some footage, actually, if we were going to take our film into present day, there were footage of 19, 20-year-olds talking about how awesome it was to be in charge of the most powerful weapons. It was kind of a scary, I mean, they were sweet young kids, but it was very frightening to see that. But
yeah. Well, what's changed is that the nuclear weapons themselves are safer today than they were in 1980. One of the themes of my book is about some very heroic people within the Pentagon bureaucracy who fought on behalf of making these warheads safer as we continue to have accidents that the Pentagon was denying. The missiles are safer today because the missile in the film was a liquid-fueled missile, and today we have solid-fuel missiles that are much less prone to exploding in their silo. Unfortunately, these are still extremely complicated technological systems. And one of the themes of my book, and I think of the film, is that we're much better at creating complex technological systems than we are at controlling them or knowing what to do about them when they go wrong. There have been reports of drug use among missile launch officers in the last few years. One of the commanders of our missile forces was removed from duty for drunken behavior. Another commander was removed from duty for gambling debts. These are human beings involved in a system that has the potential for catastrophic accidents. And unfortunately, that threat remains to this day.
Today we are speaking about the new documentary Command and Control, which opens Friday throughout the Bay Area. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Robert Kenner is director of the film. Eric Schlosser is investigative journalist and the author of several books, including Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident, and The Illusion of Safety, the book upon which the film is based. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. This issue, unfortunately, doesn't get that much attention. We did do a show a couple of months ago about President Obama's plan to upgrade the nuclear arsenal. It's a 30-year plan expected to cost $1 trillion. A lot of administration officials, former officials, say the plan is unaffordable and unneeded. Nuclear weapons did get some attention during the first presidential debate, but overall it doesn't get that much. So what questions do you have? Are you concerned about a nuclear accident on U.S. soil? If you've ever worked at a nuclear site, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. It was really amazing to watch the footage because I realized watching this that I don't know what these things look like. I don't know what these sites look like. And the site that you focused on, the Titan II missile complex in Damascus, Arizona, it's very unassuming, obviously, very secretive. But you've got this sort of, it's like a white overlap kind of thing, a square. And then when you walk under a door and go underground, it's just amazing to see what technology has allowed to be built.
Well, there were 54 Titan II sites in the United States in 1980. Today, there's only one remaining site, which is in Arizona. Damascus, the accident was in Damascus, Arkansas. This one site, they're all actually absolutely identical to each other. Hmm. So I didn't realize how to turn Eric's book into a film until we got access to this one last site. And ultimately, the Air Force and the museum where this site exists, an amazing location to go visit, by the way, enabled us to make, in effect, a film as a thriller because we were able sort of to bring this incident to light by being able to shoot in a Titan II missile silo, being able to put a drone between the missile and the wall that's 4 feet away. And the location is totally 1980 period, absolutely identical to where it took place. And it enabled us to tell the story of everybody that was involved that night and bring it to light.
Was it hard to get access?
It took a while to get access, and by the end, the people, the Air Force and the lady running, the former missileer running the site, became so enthusiastic and so helpful, and actually a bunch of the Air Force guys came and did the ADR work for us, adding the extra voices, and they were all fantastic and couldn't have been more helpful.
What struck you the most about the people you interviewed? I mean, it it was very emotional for many of them to revisit what happened.
It was a very emotional story. The man, Dave Powell, who dropped the socket that night. First of all, these guys scattered. They were very close to each other, and many of them lost touch right after that night. I won't go into exactly what happened. Hopefully you'll see the film and figure that one. But Dave Powell, who dropped the socket, was very emotionally disturbed and came to talk, and I realized I didn't think he was fully presenting his story, and I asked him to come back, and it was very hard for him, and he really said, you know, basically he closes his eyes and he sees this incident every day of his life now. And it turned out that he had not told his mother about this incident some 30-something, 35 years later, until he took her to see the film 3 weeks ago.
What was her reaction?
Well, I think what's happened is Dave's been embraced by former Secretary of Defenses and by all sorts of people, including the Air Force now. And I think if you see the film, that these men were real heroes, and they were not treated well by the Air Force at that time, and the Air Force is trying to make up for it today.
Eric, what would you add?
I would just add that it was much easier to blame human error by the little guys, by the operators, than to acknowledge fundamental problems in the system itself. And in order to defend the system, they sacrificed these young guys who behaved with incredible honor and bravery. And it's remarkable. You know, we did a screening in Washington and a screening in New York. Some of these guys had not seen one another since the night of the accident. They had been a very close-knit group of young airmen. And after this accident, they were traumatized. They were blamed for the accident. They were spread throughout the United States. And you know, when you talk about human error, there's the human error of dropping a tool, which is what precipitated the accident. But there's also the human error inherent in these systems. The fact that you build them at all maybe is a human error. And the fact that they're flawed and inherently flawed, I think, is a reflection of our inability to create anything that's perfect.
We have an email from Dan who says, one aspect of our current nuclear arsenal and its upgrade that rarely gets discussed is that the nuclear research labs in Berkeley and Los Alamos are, since 2007, privately managed by a consortium led by the San Francisco-based Bechtel Corporation. What, if any, effect does this have on the prospects of nuclear weapons reduction and the public's ability to engage with these policies?
Yeah, I think that for much of the Cold War, the labs were run essentially as nonprofits. And since they've been privatized, we've seen a series of serious problems in the management of the nuclear weapons complex. Huge cost overruns. Mm-hmm. Los Alamos, which was privatized, was responsible for a ridiculous nuclear waste accident in New Mexico, in which our largest nuclear waste repository was contaminated by an exploding drum of nuclear waste that had been shipped from Los Alamos. And the human error there is they used the wrong type of kitty litter as a moderator to stabilize the plutonium. So I have real questions about the management of our nuclear arsenal by private companies, certainly by private companies that have a strong profit motive.
It's terrifying. I didn't know it.
Well, and what about that when you follow the money? Because we did a show about Obama's plan to upgrade the arsenal, and Reuters reports that in the 2017 defense budget, the president called for a $1.8 billion increase to overhaul bombers, missiles, subs, and other systems. But the larger plan to overhaul the arsenal over 30 years would cost $1 trillion. And here is a really key quote. In Defense News, Brian McKeon, a principal deputy undersecretary of Defense for Policy, outlined the issue back in October at a nuclear security event. He said the major bill coming will require serious debate for the next president. Quote, we're wondering how the heck we're going to pay for it and probably thanking our stars we won't be here to have to answer that question.
Yeah. Well, there's definitely a financial incentive among defense contractors for all of these weapons to be built. But you've got to put in perspective the amount that's spent on nuclear weapons versus the rest of the defense budget. I mean, we're going to spend $1 trillion in our defense budget on defense in less than 2 years.
Right.
So if we were to eliminate the nuclear weapons component of it, these companies would still have an enormous amount of business. And that's not to minimize the financial incentive or dismiss it entirely, but I think there are much bigger issues at work than the financial incentive. Nuclear weapons have become a symbol of power. They're a symbol of national power, and I think that the reason that a lot of people in this country are holding on to them, embracing them so much, is because they convey our might and not necessarily just the profit motive.
Robert.
For me, I thought it was important to make the film Command and Control just because of this incredible amnesia that's taken over in this country. And today, I think just people are just not thinking about this issue at all. And as Harold Brown says in the film, you know, on one hand, our weapons are safer today, but on the other hand, it's more dangerous because we're not concerned by them, which is really frightening, because we've just taken them for granted that, you know, you hear these things that could destroy the planet. And I think Damascus is, you know, interesting because it's emblematic of the whole situation, that it's a little mistake that almost could destroy so much of this country. And these mistakes are being made all the time because it's human beings interacting with this incredible technology. So I think it was our goal to sort of make this film to get people, in a way, we're making a thriller, not a sort of a medicine film, but to get people thinking about an issue that is really important and hopefully starting to discuss, as we might be spending $1 trillion on it. It shouldn't be just a few people in Washington talking about it. It should be the American public.
Right. Well, and this issue obviously was huge in the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah.
But do you think more people would care about it if it got more attention?
Yeah, I think that was our goal, is to sort of shine a light or at least show one incident that is representative, and that not only to the past but to the present, so that we really need to be thinking about this. And in the 80s, as I said, you know, there were huge demonstrations, and it really affected world leaders from Ronald Reagan to, you know, Gorbachev. And we shrank from 70,000 worldwide weapons to something like 15, and hopefully we can continue to, you know, shrink and potentially eliminate these things.
And, you know, the film, we're talking about the issues of nuclear weapons, but the film that Robbie made really is a techno-thriller, like a Tom Clancy-style techno-thriller, with the one difference being that this is a techno-thriller in which nothing works. And that's far much closer to reality than the kind of Hollywood fictions with all these high-tech gadgets that save the world. It may be the high-tech gadgets are going to end the world. People who see the film are amazed, and particularly people under the age of 40 who really have grown up without living in nuclear dread, have grown up without an awareness of these weapons. And there's this misperception that when the Cold War ended, the threat of nuclear weapons vanished with it. But it never went away. And I think, you know, my book and this film are an attempt to remind people that these machines are out there, ready to be used and waiting to kill you.
And the documentary Command and Control opens on Friday at the Clay Theater in San Francisco and Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. The film looks at an incident in 1980 at an Air Force base in Arkansas when a worker accidentally punctured the fuel tank of a ballistic missile carrying the most powerful nuclear warhead in the U.S. arsenal. The film is based on Eric Schlosser's book Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety. Robert Kenner is the director of the film, and we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have for Eric and Robert about this incident in 1980 and what we know today? If you were a nuclear weapons activist back in the day, what are your thoughts about the fact that this doesn't get as much attention? Is this an issue that you're still following? If you work on these issues, we'd love to hear from you. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call, on the telephone, or by sending an email to feedback at yourcallradio.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio if you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone. The call number at toll-free is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Coming up in a half an hour here on KLW, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you are free tonight, I'm moderating an event about 19th century California Indian slavery and genocide. It's at 518 Valencia at 16th Street in the Mission at 7:30, and you can find more information online or on our Facebook page. And on tomorrow's show, we'll be talking about new museums and exhibits that tell the story of African American history. There's so much going on right now. The Black Panthers' 50th anniversary is at the Oakland Museum. The Whitney Plantation is the only slavery museum in Louisiana. And then the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture just opened in Washington. It's getting rave reviews. So is the true story of Black history finally being told? That is tomorrow. Today, we are talking about a new documentary, Command and Control. And I actually got my dates wrong. It opens next Friday in San Francisco and in Berkeley, and I hope you can see it. It tells the story of an incident in 1980 at an Air Force base in Arkansas when a worker accidentally punctured the fuel tank of a ballistic missile carrying the most powerful nuclear warhead in the U.S. arsenal. And it's actually really shocking just to see the sheer size of this missile. I mean, I've never really seen one before. It's over 8 stories, is that right?
Yeah,
almost 10 stories.
10 stories, yeah.
Because if you're standing, you cannot see the warhead because it's so tall.
And the fuels that are in that missile, yeah, you can't see. It's incredibly huge. It's an amazing missile. And being in that location was extraordinary. But the fuels in that missile get it across the ocean to Russia or China in something like 20, 25 minutes. So it's incredibly powerful, and that's without not talking about the warhead on top of it. And it actually turns out was capable of blowing a door that was on top of it that was supposed to protect it from a Russian hydrogen explosion, and that door was blown to smithereens by just the missile.
So. And that is Robert Kenner, director of the new documentary Command and Control. We're also joined by Eric Schlosser, investigative journalist and author of Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety, the book upon which the film is based. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. We had a caller who doesn't want to go on the air, but wants you both to ask about the temperament of the possible next president, the significance of that, who gets the codes, who has the authority to set something like this off.
Well,
Robert?
I'll start by saying that to declare war, you need to go to Congress to get their approval. But to fire a missile, the president has the sole authority and capability of doing that.
Because we always hear about this 3 o'clock a.m.
Yeah.
phone call.
Of which, in this film, we almost included numbers of times where there were false alarms right after the Damascus incident. Secretary of Defense at that point, Brzezinski, gets a call saying, we have 200 Russian missiles heading our way, and then, you have X number of minutes, and then a minute later said, we made a mistake. There are really 2,000 missiles heading our way. You have a minute less to decide. And then it turns out it was a training tape and a false alarm. But this is all a matter of minutes, and these things have happened a few times.
How do you get that information?
Well, that was – how did you – I read it in Eric's book and then spoke to Brzezinski, who didn't want to talk about it.
There were congressional investigations at the time. There were – it was actually in 1979, before the Damascus accident, there were two major false alarms – from NORAD, that early warning headquarters inside Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado, And twice within a year, the leadership of the United States was told that there was a nuclear attack underway from the Soviet Union. In one case, it was a training tape that had been inadvertently put into the NORAD computer, and it was a very realistic account of a Soviet attack. That partially inspired the film War Games. And the incident in which Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor to Carter at the time, he was woken up at 2 in the morning and told that we were under attack. He really believed that we were under attack and decided not to wake up his wife, who was sleeping beside him in bed, because if Washington was to be destroyed, he wanted her to die in her sleep. And it turned out that there was a computer chip that had failed. It was, you know, a computer chip that cost less than a dollar that was generating all these fake Soviet missiles. Back to the temperament. Right now, in the military, in order to work with nuclear weapons, you have to go through something called the Personnel Reliability Program. And it's a series of psychological evaluations and background checks to make sure that it's okay for you to work with nuclear weapons. So the kinds of things that they're looking for are emotional stability, truthfulness. So if you have a history of lying, you would be disqualified. If you have any kind of financial impropriety in your background, huge credit card debts or anything like that, you would be disqualified from working with nuclear weapons. So if you put together emotional stability, lying, financial improprieties, you can't handle nuclear weapons. So I think that same sort of criteria should be should be applied to the person who could launch these nuclear weapons. I mean, the President of the United States has the power, unchecked power, to make a decision that would kill hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people. Mm-hmm. And in an attack scenario, would have to make that decision in 7 or 8 minutes. And as I said, you know, in the 1970s, we had these false alarms. So I think that's something that people should keep in mind when they go to the voting booth.
Well, thank you for that phone call and question. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. When we talk about these incidents, in the film you mentioned that while the Department of Defense has records of about 32 incidents, they call these broken arrows that could have endangered the public. The Department of Energy says there have been more than 1,000. So is the federal government required to share this information with the public? I mean, how can we get a real sense of how many accidents there have been?
Well, let me just start by saying I think Eric did an incredible service by uncovering all of these broken arrows that had not been really known to the public, but not only that, they had not been known to the people that were in charge of designing our weapons and developing safety systems for our weapons. The fact that they were kept secret from them is what makes this whole system that much more dangerous. So I think Eric, you know, by uncovering this, was doing a great service.
There was so much compartmentalized secrecy during the Cold War that the people who designed the weapons and the safety mechanisms of the weapons weren't being told of accidents in the field. And the people who were operating the weapons and handling the weapons and repairing the weapons in the field weren't being told about fundamental safety issues with the weapons. And they might have handled them a little more carefully. Now, the official Pentagon list of broken arrow is 32. But when you look at some of those accidents, sometimes they involved weapons that were not fully assembled and could not have even detonated full scale. I got a document through the Freedom of Information Act that listed more than 1,000 accidents and incidents involving nuclear weapons just from 1950 to 1968. Mm. So the real number is unknown. And the Pentagon again and again has tried to suppress this information. Keep it secret, as Robbie said, keep it secret even from the people who most needed to know this information, the weapons designers. And we don't really know how many accidents there have been. There was one 2 years ago at a Minuteman silo in Colorado. We don't know the details of it. There was a work crew. It's very similar to the accident in the film. There was a work crew doing maintenance on a missile. They did something wrong. They called in another work crew the next day who did something seriously wrong and damaged the missile. And the Associated Press has sued under the Freedom of Information Act to get the details of this accident so we can know how serious it was. This is May of 2014.
Wow. And when we look at what happened in 1980, again, someone dropped a socket which punctured a fuel tank. It was just a small piece of metal. Could something like that happen again?
Well, it happened continually throughout our history where people make simple mistakes, and a simple mistake that can have consequences that are unimaginable. Earlier that week, someone forgot to put a little screw in, what was it, a gas?
A fuel strainer.
A fuel strainer on a B-52 that had how many, 10?
12.
12 hydrogen weapons, and that, you know, that thing was engulfed. The B-52 was engulfed in flames. Thank goodness the wind was blowing in the other direction away from the weapons. So these things are happening throughout our history. But, Rose, I just want to say one thing about the film Command and Control. Unlike Merchants of Doubt or even Food, Inc., which are sort of looking at different ways that our systems operate, we set out to make a real thriller. So in a way, it's kind of like a horror film, but an action, techno action thriller that is some levels entertaining but terrifying simultaneously. Mm. And then people can start to think about this issue after seeing it.
And all these bigger themes and issues are implicit in this very simple story of a guy drops a tool. And then nobody knows what to do. And the film that Robbie made is a ticking clock film in which once the missile's pierced, the clock is ticking as to what is going to happen. Will the missile explode? Will the warhead detonate? And these sorts of accidents continue to the present day.
One of the most, you know, sort of terrifying interviews was the commander of the Arkansas missile base. And when he lost contact at one point with the base, he basically fell to his knees thinking that the weapon had gone off and so much of, you know, our country was devastated, and he was just waiting for the shock waves to hit. And yeah, you can only imagine what that would have been like for this man.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was amazing to watch these guys, older men now, remember what happened when they were 19 or 23. I forgot the name of this man, but he said there was no checklist. It was a seat of the pants operation.
That was the commander who Robbie mentioned. I mean, in order to have 19, 20, 21-year-old kids working on nuclear weapons, as they are right now as we speak, you need elaborate checklists. The checklists are the embodiment of the knowledge about what to do, so that you don't need a nuclear physicist working on the weapon. You can have a 20-year-old kid and he just follows the checklist. And you need these checklists. You really do. The problem is sometimes there's an event and the checklist no longer applies. And this weapon, the Titan II missile, had been on alert, fully fueled, ready to go for about 16 years when this accident happened, but nothing like this had ever happened before. So there was no checklist, and nobody knew what to do. And someone came to a screening that we had in Los Angeles the other night who had worked on this weapon system and who saw the film and, you know, felt the film was accurate and just said, we all knew that this weapon was obsolete and should have been taken off of duty years before. So in many ways, it was just an accident waiting to happen. Mm.
It was a lady who had worked in the – it was the one of the people who would turn the keys.
Wow. So. Robert Kenner is director of the new documentary Command and Control, which looks at an incident in 1980 at an Air Force base in Arkansas when a worker accidentally punctured the fuel tank of a ballistic missile carrying the most powerful nuclear warhead in the U.S. arsenal. And the film opens next Friday in Berkeley and San Francisco. You can find more information and watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Eric Schlosser, investigative journalist and author of the book Command and Control, the book upon which the film is based. And Eric and Robert are hoping that this film raises more awareness about nuclear weapons and gets people talking about them and concerned about them, asking questions. So what are your thoughts? This is an issue that doesn't get that much attention. It did in the last debate because Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump said nuclear weapons are the greatest threat facing the U.S., but they were referring to the weapons in the hands of terrorists. It would have been great for the moderator to say, well, what about the weapons that are here in the U.S.? But he didn't. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Bill who says, NPR News reported yesterday that Russia is probably going to revive its full nuclear capability because the United States has cheated in its plutonium abatement by rendering supposed inert plutonium reusable. Can you explain what that means?
Yes. It's a little bit complicated, and that's not a fully accurate description of what happened. After the Cold War, Russia had enormous amounts. I can't tell you, but a huge amounts of plutonium. And we made a deal with Russia that some of that plutonium would be shipped to the United States and processed so that it could not be used in weapons again. And this gets back to the privatization of our national labs. So they were going to build a huge facility, I believe, in South Carolina that was going to reprocess this Russian plutonium so it couldn't be used in weapons. The problem was that the cost of building this facility kept on skyrocketing and skyrocketing and skyrocketing because of bureaucratic mismanagement. So the decision was made not to build this facility, and we were going to come up with a different way of handling the plutonium and eventually burying it. Russia decided that this was a violation of the agreement that they had with us and decided to pull out of it. But it was not a nefarious attempt by the United States to take that plutonium and make weapons out of it. We have more than enough plutonium in this country right now. I mean, we already have 7,000 weapons, so there is no plutonium shortage. It's a much more complicated issue, but what it really speaks to is the extraordinary incompetence of our weapons labs and our weapons establishment at their failure to build this facility that we had agreed to build at a reasonable cost.
And plutonium is a radioactive chemical element,
Plutonium is a fissile material. The two fissile materials that have traditionally been used in the making of nuclear weapons are uranium-235 and plutonium. And these are materials that you can start a chain reaction and then cause a huge explosion.
Wow. So what should we make of this, that Russia is suspending its plutonium deal with the U.S.? How significant is that?
It's just one more indication of the breakdown in relations between the United States and Russia and the rise of a new Cold War. In isolation, it's not a profound event, but as part of a series of events that are very, very disturbing and I think extremely dangerous. I mean, one of the themes of my book is it's almost miraculous that we escaped the Cold War without a city being destroyed by a nuclear weapon, or cities, or an all-out nuclear war. I mean, we almost had a nuclear war because of a training tape that someone put into one of our computers. So given that history, the idea of another Cold War is just absurd and must be avoided at all costs. So despite the differences that the United States and Russia have on a great, long series of issues, it's not in the interest of either country to have another nuclear arms race and another Cold War.
The incident at Damascus was actually in the news. We gathered a bunch of footage from national news, local news, but it was sort of misrepresented because it was talking about a missile that exploded while the Air Force was saying there was never a chance that the actual warhead could explode. So these are stories that were kind of hidden from us during the Cold War. They're still being hidden from us today. And ultimately, we need to sort of, sunlight's the best disinfectant. We need to sort of get these things out there and start thinking about what is such a dangerous situation.
And the question that really needs to be asked is, again, right now as we're sitting here, the United States has hundreds of missiles with warheads vastly more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima, ready to be used within a minute. That's why they're called Minuteman missiles. And Russia has hundreds of missiles pointed at this country. And you have to ask, why? What is the interest in slaughtering millions of Russian civilians and millions of American civilians? I mean, what is the real grievance between these two countries that they would put themselves in a potential to cause mass annihilation of civilians on both sides? And one of my concerns is, even if you assume competent, emotionally stable, reasonable leadership on both sides, which that's a big assumption, these systems are so complicated that they lend themselves to mistakes, to errors, and accidents that can be devastating. I mean, former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry had an op-ed in the New York Times this past week calling for the elimination of all of our land-based missiles, and one of the reasons that he's concerned about it is accidental nuclear war. Now, those three words should never even, there should be no reason to put those three words together. Accidental nuclear war, that's just madness. Mm.
Do you think the public doesn't spend much time on this, or the media definitely don't spend much time on this? Is that because people think this could never happen?
I think that there is just historical amnesia. When the Cold War ended without a nuclear war, without a war at all, when the Berlin Wall came down without any violence at all, it was incredible. It was grounds for celebration. And there was just a sense that when that happened, the threat of nuclear war went away. Half the population of the United States was not yet born or were small children when the Cold War ended. So they don't have any personal memory of this. So the issue has sort of receded from consciousness. You know, we were talking to some students last night at Berkeley. If you're a freshman at Berkeley, you're 18 years old, you were -7 when the Cold War ended. So there's got to be a kind of a reminder of this issue, and I think Robbie's film does an extraordinary job. Again, not in an—and this isn't an insult to Robbie, not in an intellectual, cerebral way. It's a powerful, visceral story that makes very clear what's at stake. Not what was at stake at 1980, but what's at stake right now.
But because it's hard to take this in, and I think it's a relief not to think about it. So the whole society has stopped thinking, and that's what's scary. So on some levels, that's what made us want to make a story about one incident, to do it as a thriller, to make you think about this one sort of emblematic experience and hopefully get us thinking again.
And after reading Eric's book and making this film, how has your opinion of nuclear weapons changed?
Well, it made me realize, Eric just did an article for The New Yorker talking about 50 weapons we had on a base in Turkey where the power was cut off during the coup. It was right near the Syrian border, right near where ISIS is. And I'm thinking, you know, those weapons don't make me feel safer. I'm scared of a terrorist group getting these weapons. I think that's more real than us needing to use them to fire against the Russians, frankly. I think that absolutely fewer of these things would make me feel safer, and potentially getting down to zero would make us even safer than that. So realizing the chance for an accident, because human beings are controlling these things. And like after Damascus, they realized, you know, maybe we'll put a safety net where this guy dropped the socket and you have to refuel the missile. So they blamed it on the guy for dropping it, but then the Air Force thought, oh, a safety net could be a good thing. So there are always things that go wrong. And I think the fewer of them there are, and perhaps getting down to zero, will make us safer.
What did you think when you heard the announcement from the Obama administration about its plan to overhaul the nuclear arsenal over 30 years for the cost of $1 trillion?
I think our president has been terrific on the issue of nuclear weapons. He gave a speech in 2009 calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons that was so far ahead of the political awareness. I mean, he put himself way out on a limb. The modernization of our arsenal was a deal that had to be struck with the Republicans in order to get approval for an arms control treaty with the Russians in 2009. And I really believe that when this administration struck that deal, they didn't expect that all this money was actually going to be spent. They made the promise to do it, but now in the next few years is when the money is going to have to be committed, and that's why we need a real debate over nuclear weapons in this country. We need a public discussion, as Robbie said, so that the decisions about this arsenal, which is of existential importance, these decisions are made by the American people and not by a small group of policymakers often acting in secret in Washington, D.C.
And what can the public do about this?
Well, the public can get engaged in the issue. I mean, it's an issue like climate change. I mean, to me, the two greatest threats that we face are nuclear weapons and climate change. And the difference is climate change is unfolding relatively slowly, and the detonation of a nuclear weapon will be instantaneous and irreversible. So people can get involved by contacting their elected officials. There are all kinds of groups that are engaged in the nuclear issue. I think, as Robbie said earlier, if you look at the 1980s, we had some of the biggest political demonstrations in our history against nuclear weapons. There was a demonstration in Central Park in 1982 that almost a million people attended. It got the notice of the Congress. The nuclear freeze movement was hugely successful, and it got the notice of the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan took office wanting to greatly enlarge our nuclear arsenal. He left office genuinely, sincerely committed to abolishing nuclear weapons. And I think one of the reasons that the Cold War ended peacefully is that both Reagan and Gorbachev realized that a nuclear war would be catastrophic, and public opinion, not just in the United States but throughout Europe, had a huge impact.
Eric Schlosser is an investigative journalist and the author of Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident and the Illusion of Safety. Robert Kenner is director of the new film Command and Control, which opens next Friday in Berkeley and San Francisco. Robert was on talking about his last film, Merchants of Doubt, which looks at climate change, and I hope you can also see that film. Eric and Robert, thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much, Rose.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we're talking about new museums and exhibits that tell the stories of African American history. The Black Panthers' 50th anniversary at the Oakland Museum, the Whitney Plantation is the only slavery museum in Louisiana, and the new Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington. Is the true story of Black history finally being told? Tweet your questions and comments to @YourCallRadio and join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners.